Angie's List is now Angie, and we've heard a lot of theories about why.
I thought it was an eco move. Fewer words, less paper.
No, it was so you could say it faster.
No, it's to be more iconic.
Must be a tech thing.
But those aren't quite right. It's because now you can compare upfront prices, book a service instantly, and even get your project handled from start to finish.
Sounds easy.
It is, and it makes us so much more than just a list. Get started at Angie.com. That's A-N-G-I. Or download the app today.
Welcome back to Kotaku Split Screen for another bonus episode of the show. Kirk and I are here in San Francisco for GDC, and we're going to talk about some exciting stuff. My name is Jason Schreier, of course, and I am joined, as always, by Kirk Hamilton.
Hello, Jason. I'm starting to think that maybe we just do bonus episodes now. Like, we're just the bonus.
Well, wait until people hear what we have planned for this week.
Finally, at long last.
Let me introduce our other guests. Our only guests.
Yeah.
First, starting to my direct left, is the wonderful IGN executive editor.
Yep.
Andrew Goldfarb. Hello, hello. Andrew.
Hello.
That was just a total wild stab at your title. So
no, that was good.
We have the same title.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. Okay. And to Andrew's left is the other wonderful executive editor of IGN, Marty Sliva.
Beautiful. Yeah.
Hello, Mark.
Perfect. I like that we're here at GDC at the Game Developer Conference to talk about what we're talking about.
Yes. For a bunch of game journalists, not game developers, to sit around and talk about an HBO show.
So it's very important. So I haven't gotten there.
Oh, yeah.
Yet.
Oh, yeah, right. We could be talking about video games for all people now.
Yeah. Are we talking about Arliss?
Yeah. So, we're talking about ballers. Oh, no. Are you guys ready?
So we have decided to get together and talk about the one thing that's on everybody's minds. Mm-hmm. Blockchain.
Yeah, can't wait.
Just very kidding. Excited. We are here to talk about the leftovers because Kirk and I have been promising this for some time now.
Yes.
And so we decided that we'd get two other leftovers super fans together in a room to talk about this show. I just watched it. Kirk and I just refreshed ourselves on some shows. And we watched the season one and season two finales.
This was particularly entertaining because watching my girlfriend Emily has never seen this show, but she sat with us while we watched. So she just got to watch the season one and season two finales.
It's a very confusing show.
Out of context.
She kept asking questions.
Wow, this is a wild show.
They're gonna blow up the entire town.
There's a C4 in the trailer.
Well, that was just as confusing even if you were watching for it. Like, you had actually watched this.
Pretty much.
And you guys, so Andrew, you had watched them as they were airing.
Yes. Well, I caught up. I think it was you told me how much you love season one. Mm-hmm. So I caught up on season one right before season two started airing.
Okay.
And then I rewatched season one and two before season three started.
So you should You should remember it all.
It's
pretty
been
well.
A few months, but okay. I'm pretty good.
Yeah. I read the Thomas Peralta book when it came out.
Nice.
And so I was stoked for the show from episode one. And that deviated a ton, which I was totally fine with. But
so you are the biggest obsessive here.
Yeah, but I also drink a lot, so I forget things. So I'm the biggest obsessive, but also I have that little asterisk at the end.
That sounds like the Tyrion Lannister quote, except the opposite.
Yeah, exactly.
I drink and I forget things.
I drink and I forget TV shows that I watch.
Okay, Tyrion cool. Lannister so I should warn everybody who just happened to turn this on and was like, oh, The Leftovers, what's this? That we will be spoiling the show. We'll be getting in depth about this wonderful TV show. So if you have not watched it and you are tuning in, you should go. Just go fucking watch it. It's on HBO Go or whatever.
Go fuck yourself. I was like, wow.
Yeah.
If you haven't watched it, fuck off. We don't want
you. Really,
we
hate your fan base.
We're not that abusive to our listeners.
This is Kotaku. We're an edgy publication.
Yeah, we're going all out. So we will be spoiling the hell out of the show. And yeah, why don't we start by going around and like talking about why we love it so much? Why it Andrew, why don't you start by telling us all why it resonated so much with you?
I secretly love sad things. I not so secretly love sad things. I mean, I think it's a show mostly about grief and about loss and like that. I know, like I was watching at a time where that hit me pretty hard, and I think like especially leading into season two and then season three, like when on top of that theme it got weird, it was just like hitting everything for me. Like it like did like everything I want from a show.
So weird.
It's so bizarre. And like when it really gets off the rails, which like obviously we'll get to, like late season two when it like really starts getting fucking weird, is when I was just like, this is one of my favorite shows ever.
I read I was reading some, you know, season finale recaps and stuff before we did this, and somebody described it, I think this was in the New Yorker, might have been Emily Nussbaum, she said a friend of hers just described season one as a bummer and then season two as a bummer party.
And then season three is a bummer party acid
like,
trip.
Yeah, when the drugs kick in. Exactly.
Yeah. Marty, what about you?
Yeah, it's totally, I'm a huge fan of like things that just put their characters through the ringer. And the fact that like the premise is so harrowing. And the fact that the show concentrates on the Garveys who lost no one, I think is like one of the smartest like angles to the show is when you realize at the end of that episode, like you're concentrating on a family that by all intents and purposes, they dodged a bullet here.
Right.
And yet they're more fucked up than anyone else on the show. That combined with, like Andrew was saying, sort of the, when it starts delving into magical realism, like the opening of season two and three, and then the international assassin and and then the most important man in the world and his identical twin brother.
Oh my God, such a good episode.
Yeah,
title.
Seriously, like those episodes to me, like it just, it takes the harrowing nature of what happened to these characters and the survivors, but then just completely fucking throws it at the wall. And like we were saying on the way up, like it reminds me of the best shades of Lost or even like the Sopranos in that way.
Yeah, so the Lost comparison, obviously, but in case people aren't aware, the showrunner on The Leftovers is Damon Lindelof, who's also a showrunner on Lost. And it is clear, so he was a showrunner on Lost with Carlton Cuse, who helped him run things, and it is clear after watching The Leftovers that Damon was incredibly talented. I don't want to say that Carlton Cuse isn't talented, but like some of the best writing clearly has come from Damon, because this show, he has done a fantastic job.
Yeah. Feels kind of like he learned a lot from running Lost.
It does.
And sometimes even feels like a direct apology for Lost. Yeah.
Well, it does, because instead of saying, all right, we're going to set up all these incredible mysteries and then answer them, it's just like, no, we're not going to answer shit.
Life is a mystery.
Yeah.
And from the beginning, they pretty much established that, which I think is really smart of them, because they set expectations. Really
to your point, by the way, that you made before about the Garveys, like watching the beginning and not knowing that they didn't lose anyone, the show does this great misdirect. I don't know if you guys remember, but they talk just at the beginning about how he lost his wife and how he was in the middle, like you see a brief flashback of him in the middle of having sex when someone disappears, and at the beginning you think that that's going to be his wife, but then you find out at the end that she joined the cult, the guilty remnant at the end of that pilot, and then later you find out that he was cheating on someone
so
else
good.
And she disappeared, and that so it's just a great setup,
that flashback episode later, the Garveys
that's
like so my good. Favorite season one episode.
Yes, very good. Very, very good. So Kirk, why did it resonate with you? You didn't answer the question.
Well, so I really like the fact that this show is super well made. I mean, this is not like the main reason it resonates with me, but I think it's like an incredibly well made show. Rewatching those episodes with you over the weekend, it was just like, it does a lot of audiovisual stuff that's just on a level that's better than
the
almost any other show.
So good.
I discovered Mimi Leder, who I was like not aware of, the director who is like the all-star director of this show, and directed, I think, like 10 episodes. All of the best episodes are directed by her. I think that they got a cast that's totally out of control. Carrie Coon is like ridiculous, and and everyone's so up for it. I mean, I've seen Justin Theroux and other stuff, but like I didn't know he was this up for it. Every actor is like so raw in scenes, and just watching that kind of humanity is cool. But I think the thing I really love about this show is the way that it embraces ambiguity. I think that we're kind of in this weird era. You and I talked about this when we did our Westworld podcast, sort of where there's like everything is a puzzle, everything is, you know, crowdsourced on Reddit, people are always cracking codes and coming up with theories. And this show deliberately confounds that in a way that's a lot truer to the nature of like life and spirituality and, you know, faith and grief and all these things that it's exploring. They're all things that live in some weird sort of ambiguous space, and then the way that it creates this world with like a piece missing is crazy. I don't know how you do something like how you have a tone that consistent across that many different kind of like other tones. You know, this show gets funny and it gets tragic and it gets surreal and like tense, and it does, they do a lot of tones, but throughout all of it there's this feeling that there's just something missing. There's like every scene you're like, oh, this world isn't quite our world, it's basically our world but it isn't quite, because it's like missing 2%. It's like you know, not just the people but everything, and I think that's like amazing. I don't know how they did it. I really want to rewatch the whole show now, actually, after watching those, and get more of a sense for that, but that's, it really is just incredible.
Well, and it's such a, because what is it, was it 5% of the world, was it less, was it
2%?
And it's amazing that in the grand scheme of things, that's not, it's a lot of people.
The world would carry on.
But the world would carry on.
I think they said it was 140 million people.
Yeah. But it's like that incident just completely knocks the record off kilter.
Right.
And like, so, and that's like what you're saying is like the rest of the show, it moves on, but you're like, this is different. This is not the same world we know, even though it's not futuristic, it's not sci-fi at all.
Well, and that's why the world building, like, it's so smart. Like, when they mention which celebrities are gone, and it's like the Pope, and it's like there's like these little ones who are like, oh, well, like that would throw organized religion.
Yeah, like, hey, the dude from Perfect Strangers, like, that's so fucking good.
That episode is really
absolutely incredible.
The part where the opening credits start with the Perfect Strangers theme song, I was like, what the fuck?
They fucked with it so much in season 3.
What is that? Perfect Strangers,
the theme song itself, changing. When season 2 begins, you're generally like, did I turn on the right show?
What am I watching? Literally, what is this?
And it's just so well done. Like, I think for me, season 2 is probably the tightest. I think that I love season 3, and season 3, like, we were talking about this at lunch. I think season 3 probably has higher highs for me, but I think season 2 is when it got weird in the best way and kind of like found itself. I think season 1 is almost hard to go back and rewatch because it's so grounded that it tends to feel like a different show.
Well, to some extent, so having watched them all very recently, I binged them all like a month ago. Season 1, so let's go in order. Let's talk about season 1.
Well, wait, I want to hear why you like the show.
Well, a couple of reasons, but I just want to make this point. So season 1, the part that really that hooked me, like, I thought the first two episodes were good, but I didn't get hooked until the third episode, which is where Matt, the priest, is on his journey to get $200,000 to save his church, and in the end does it. But that's when they start introducing some really weird shit, because he is like, he sees this vision of this crow, and it's on the red light, and so he knows to go play everything on red, like put all his money on red, and then he gets robbed in the parking lot and just beats the shit out of the guy who robs him and just takes the money back. And it just does this, these, all these interesting spiritual and subverting things that I really enjoyed. And I feel like, you're right that obviously they don't go to the afterlife until much later, but I think from the beginning it had that Lost-ish, like, spiritual, like, definitely heavily religious, a lot of weirdness to it. I think one of the reasons I liked it is because I was a Lost obsessive back in the day.
Same.
Yes, you guys are too. We're all on Team
I was
Lost.
Kind of lost. I was lapsed. I liked it for two seasons and I quit liking it. And
did
then
you really?
I came back. Yeah.
Did
I didn't,
you stop
I don't
watching?
Think I've ever watched season 3. I like,
wow.
Like,
what's the writer's strike season?
I mean, when then I came back and
no,
I watched
4,
I
think, 4 is the writer's strike.
Came back and watched The Constant.
Three,
and was like, okay,
well,
this
you know,
is good.
3 3 has the, like, best twist in television history.
What, like the Jack tattoos were actually.
Yeah.
Oh, okay. If I came back to watch that, maybe.
So good.
I mean, it's funny because when you mentioned the whole, like, Reddit crowdsourcing theories, like, that for me, that was Lost.
Yeah, that was Lost.
Like, week in and week out, would be going to the forums and, like, seeing people, like,
and
take those screenshots.
Yeah, the podcast.
Well, that was one of the reasons it was so frustrating, because they set it up to be something that it wasn't. And if they had made that more like they made The Leftovers, I think it would have been, the ending would have been less controversial, and the last two seasons would have been less terrible.
Well, to challenge that a little bit.
Yeah.
So if they had made Lost more like The Leftovers, the thing is that The Leftovers' entire premise is built around this idea that an impossible, unknowable thing happened and everybody is dealing with it, right? And that's like, it's like a metaphor for death, right? Yeah. Like, death is kind of this fundamentally unknowable thing that can just turn up in your life at any time, and then you have to deal with it, and you never can truly understand it. Like, and Lost just isn't kind of, I don't know. Like, yeah, it just it doesn't really have
it's almost
that
the inverse. It's a super grounded, like, oh, there's a plane crash and people are on an island, but there's much more to it.
Right. Like, so they're constantly teasing that out of you, like, oh, be interested. There's a secret. There's a weird smoke monster and that kind of thing.
Yeah, I think your point about ambiguity earlier applies a lot to Lost, because for me, why I don't like the ending of Lost, which I won't spoil for you in case you do ever watch it, but I feel
I finished it. I watched the ending.
You just didn't watch that.
Yeah, yeah. I skipped season 3 and then got back.
Like, for me, Lost ends with too much explanation.
I agree.
Like,
I didn't care
from it, right. And I think that's why The Leftovers works so well for me, because, like, I'm getting out of order again, but, like, especially where it ends up, like, they don't really, like, they leave it totally up to your interpretation.
Yeah.
And I think there are, like, two very solid ways you can interpret the ending of that show, and that's why I love it so much.
Well, so to go back to the point I was trying to make earlier about why it resonated with me, I think a lot of reasons, but mostly because I think that Lost's biggest strength was creating these characters that you love and care about and telling these great love stories about them. Yeah. Desmond and Penny is the reason that I love Lost.
Sawyer and Juliet for me, man.
Sawyer and Juliet. Yeah. All favorite of them, couple. All of them. I'm just using them. example. Yeah. And then him taking that same exact idea and taking and making this epic love story between Kevin Garvey and Nora Durst is why I ultimately fell in love with the show.
Yeah.
But he's just great at creating these characters and telling these amazing stories, and the whole team. I shouldn't give just Damon Lindelof credit for that. So let's talk about season one a little bit. A lot of people think that, a lot of people say that season one isn't as good as the rest. That some people actually warn me, like, hey, you shouldn't even, like, season one isn't
that's
that good.
Ridiculous. That's crazy. Yeah.
They didn't say not to watch it or anything. No. I don't mean you shouldn't watch it, but they said, like, don't be prepared for it not to be great. I actually thought it was great.
It is great. Yeah. I mean, it's funny because I think, myself included, everyone I've ever talked to about the show gets hooked on that same episode in the casino. Like, I think that is definitely the point where you're like, oh, like, that's what this is going to be.
Yes. Because it's just one character, like, fuck everybody else.
Yeah, those are tend to be the strongest. Like, I liked his episodes each season, but I think, like, the single character focus ones, especially when you get to, like, Nora episodes later. Like,
so, yeah, that's the one for me.
Guest it was, is the one.
Yeah, Guest is the episode for me, anyways, where I, because first off, she rocks my world. Like, I think Carrie Coon is amazing. And every time she had been on the show up till then, she's kind of seems like a minor character.
Yeah,
but I was like, who is she? Like, I want to know more about her. She seems really interesting. And then she gets Guest, and it's like, just
was that the episode where she hires the prostitute and has the bulletproof vest?
And then
and
you basically find out her whole deal. It's where she goes.
She winds up at the hotel, there's like that dude who's selling wax figures of all the people.
Well, and someone takes her identity, and then like she's there. It's like someone takes her grief.
I'm the panel.
That's my grief.
That was like a South by Southwest panel.
Yeah,
that entire episode, like her at the hotel bar freaking out, and like just that entire sequence, and then like hugging whatever his name is, Wayne.
Holy Wayne.
Yeah. Like, man, that whole episode. I think like the casino episode, like, started hooking me, and then like it's totally true. Like, Guest is definitely the high point of that, and then Garvey's at their best. I was just like, oh, this show is so good.
And comparing it again, I don't want to bring up Lost every 5 minutes, but like, it does that thing where it introduces a new character, like when it introduces Matt, Christopher Eccleston's character, like. Every time it introduces a new character, 9 out of 10 times, their backstory is fascinating. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And it just doesn't go wrong. It never stumbles. It never has their Nikki and Paolo where you're like, why the fuck are you in the show? Like, it never does that.
It's clearly a very tight show. It's 28 total episodes, I believe.
Tell you like to a fault toward the end, which we'll probably get to when we talk about this.
Did not pay proper heed to some characters. But it's so tight. And I think that with Lost, they had the challenges of being on a network show, so they had to hit like 23 episodes, 42 minutes each.
Were they really, man? Lost seasons were really
23.
So the reason to digress a little bit, the reason that the Nikki and Paula thing happened and all the other stuff in season three is because they were fighting, Damon and Carlton were fighting to get an end date on the show. So they wound up making, and it's unclear whether it was intentional or not, but do you guys remember Stranger in a Strange Land?
Yeah, the tattoos with Biling.
The worst episode of Lost.
Yes. That was when I had tuned out.
That was the one. They took that one to the network executives and they were like, look, this is what we're going to come up with if you don't let us leave. And they were planning on leaving after season three.
They're like, this episode is so shitty that,
And finally they come to this arrangement. And I think they asked for 5 seasons and the network was like, no, 8 seasons. And eventually they compromised on 6 seasons. And then they announced, like, we're going to have a close.
And then
date.
The show immediately got better.
It got better and then it got way worse. But that's another story. Man, there's some stuff at the end, towards the end in season
six. I really remember.
They go to the temple and there's the dude Dogen.
You also can't, that season, it's like, by the end of it, they're like, oh no, this is real, don't worry about
it.
So
whole
you can't rewatch
sideways.
It. It doesn't mean anything when you rewatch it. It drives me insane.
It has some cool moments, but But anyway, back to The Leftovers. So season six is Guest. That was a great one. Then, or episode six is Guest. Episode eight, they're in the cabin and he takes Patty to the cabin and
that's a meme
she
letter.
Kills herself. That was a crazy episode. Yeah. Episode 9, Garvey's at their best, is really good. And we just watched the season 1 finale, which just does so many crazy things in that episode. Just the idea of the guilty remnant, just like, who are just terrible people, just putting together this plot where they recreate everybody's lost people and with wax figures and put them all in places.
There's a scene in that episode, the scene when Nora discovers her entire family sitting at the table, and like there's no sound and she's just like screaming in the room, and it's crazy.
Yeah, it's harrowing.
That again, that episode in particular made me want to, I wonder if there's a way to just listen to the soundscape of this show. Because it's the stuff they're doing, the composer, I'll Google the composer while you guys are talking because I'm forgetting who it is. But there's so much stuff with like weird low drones. Obviously there's like the theme music that anybody hears that music
comes. Is a violin.
Maybe I'll edit it in right now.
Yeah. Oh, it just makes me sob.
Yeah.
It was in some shitty movie trailer recently. They played the leftover
you're like,
scene.
No.
And
no,
I was like, how dare you?
Yeah, really? Was, wait, how?
How dare you, music. Rampage?
I don't know how Rampage. It probably was like Rampage.
Yeah, oh my God. They just got the rights.
So that stuff they do, like that, there's obviously there's like the more melodic stuff. There's that really memorable like piano stuff and the string arrangements. But there's also a lot of just like low, just like a tone mm-hmm. kind of playing and building on itself. And they do stuff, or like there'll be scenes, this is in the season two finale, there's a part where they're building and she's yelling at her daughter when she runs out and they're on the bridge and there's no sound. Yes. They do the same thing when Nora discovers her family. Erica, there's no sound. Erica's and she's screaming. Daughter, yeah. And there's just this like dirge of music playing, like this, like it gets louder and louder and louder and there's no sound and it's so crazy. Yeah. And I really almost feel like if you could just close your eyes and listen to this show, it would be a really cool experience. On
what
its
about
own.
All yeah. the instrumental covers of pop music?
Yeah.
They're
yeah.
so good. Yeah. I feel just like, random ass pop from like Coldplay and shit.
I feel like that's become kind of like trite at this point. Like Westworld did that in every other episode.
I don't know. I think it works so
but
well.
But they, I mean, I don't think it's, oh, I'm not at all criticizing in the leftovers. Yeah. I think they maybe kind of pioneered it and now every sure. show is going to be like, oh, let's have a, you yes. know, piano
just
cover.
It does tend to work really well. And it's always like, I'm bad at that. So it's like, I'm like well into the song. I'm like, oh, this is Coldplay. It takes me so much longer than it takes everybody else. Yeah. I think season one for me, like I do agree that it's still great. Like I definitely like would recommend to anyone. And like, I would never like skip it in a rewatch or anything like that. I think what makes it feel a little less, maybe it's almost too tight and too clean because it was the ending of the first book. Like, because it has an ending, mm-hmm. I think, like, part of it is that, like, I like that season two is a little, like, looser, a little messier. And, mm-hmm. like, I think focusing on, like, because the show is obviously about the Garveys, but, like, I think the minute that they move away from, like, the daughter's friend and, like, just those, they're, Amy. Like, extraneous characters in season one that you just don't need.
Mostly his daughter's, like, friends and twins.
Yeah. There is also, season one has a kind of a monochrome quality to it. Not, like, they're literally, like, it's, I think it's, like, entirely about white people, which is something that I noticed watching it. I remember being like, you know, everybody on this show is white. And then they're all dressed in white and everything is, like, really dour and, like, the kind of color scheme of the show
the
in general.
The mayor is black.
Is very white. Okay. Oh, yeah. So, I'm sure there are some exceptions, but just about just every
thinking,
character.
Yeah.
But then the second you get the miracle.
Exactly. Yeah. And the second and season begins and there's way more color. Like there are more people of color in the cast. The show's color scheme gets much more colorful. Yeah. The opening credits are much more colorful. So everything is, you know, just feels suddenly like this visually
engaging. I mean, I think you hit it
thing.
On the head, Andrew, that like Lindelof had to stick to Peralta's book a little bit in season one. And then season two, he got to put his weird... Two and three, he got to put his weird thumbprint
and
on.
And Miracle is such
with
a good
idea. It should be noted, Peralta is also on the show.
Yeah, that's true. Yeah.
He stayed on... Yeah, I think he stayed
he
on...
He stayed on
he
it.
He wrote some episodes. Yeah.
I think that makes a big difference.
But man, Miracle is such a smart idea. Like that... I fucking love that hook so much of like... There are so many people, like, because we talked about religion, right? And it is a show that has so much to do with religion. And when you think about people desperately clinging to faith and desperately clinging to feeling safe, like, that is totally, like, you. It is so believable that a town that lost no one would become a national park. It is so believable. Like, even the, like, I love how weird it is before they explain, like, the woman in the wedding dress and the guy cutting the, like, sacrificing the goat. Like, it's, you're like, what the fuck is happening? It does such a good job of, like, pacing out when you get answers to that stuff. It's just so
well and
well
it was
done.
Such a, like, none of us knew what season two would be about. Because even if you read the book, you're like, well, where does it go from here? And then that initial teaser, I don't know if you remember, it was just a slow panning shot of miles and miles of cars along the Texas highway, like stalled, like the cars are just stopped and like people are playing catch in the street and everything. And then panning over to the sign that said Miracle Zero Lost was just like, oh my God, this is what this is about. Like this road to Babylon. Like it's so good.
Their teasers are really smart. Like the season three teaser is really good too. It's in the airport and it's just like, it's like them like boarding a flight to the end of the world basically.
Yeah.
Wow. So season two actually opens with caveman time.
It actually
opens with a woman running. I remember being so confused at that. I thought that was Miracle Texas for a while until I realized afterwards. But so what did you guys think of that early prehistoric moment?
I genuinely did. I was like, am I like on the wrong show? Like, it really, because I like watched season one, like right, like literally, I think that I finished like on the Friday before the Sunday season two aired. And I watched the episode and was like, what?
Let me try to remember what happens. Yeah. It's she what? There's like an earthquake and everybody dies. And she winds up with a baby.
She's separated from everybody. Yeah, and she runs.
And she takes care of the baby.
And she gets bitten by snake.
Yeah. And then she dies. Yeah. Yes. But the baby is picked up by other people.
Yes. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah.
It's just wild.
What
and
the
then
fuck?
And then the entire yeah, I mean, you must have been so confused because then we go to John and his family. What the Smiths are they? Is that the last name? The Browns? What is
their they last are the
I thought it was something generic.
The Murphys.
The Murphys. I knew it was something generic. Like the Murphys. So then we're hanging out with John and his family, the Murphys, for something like half hour before we actually see any characters we know. And I think we see Matt at some point in their church. But you must have been so confused. You must have been like, what am I watching?
Yeah. I loved it though. Like, and yeah. like, I love that then in episode two, you get it from the garbage perspective.
Yes. Yeah. Right. That reminded me of Lost a lot because that was so, I think it was the beginning of their of Lost season two, where you see Jack go into the hatch and then you see Kate go into the hatch in the next episode. And then John Locke goes into the hatch. Third episode, and it shows all their different perspectives.
And it's like, you know, in a show like Lost, there are times where I get frustrated by that, where I'm like, I don't want to watch it again. I don't like the Rashomon thing. I don't want to see this again from someone else's perspective. In this show, because it doesn't matter, and it's just you're appreciating like the artfulness of how they're weaving it together.
Yeah.
Because then when we watch the finale, in the finale, they echo yet again of him kind of waving to John, and John is on his porch and kind of waves back to him, and they've gone through all this shit together, and now, you know, they're kind of back where they started.
And they do it really artfully. They're just explaining everything, as you brought up before, about like how the horse and the wedding dress, and then in episode 9 of season 2 they show the flashback of what's her face, Liv Tyler's character, Meg, and her trip, and that also helps explain some things, explains what happened to Evie by the end of it. And man, that whole plot line was such a brilliant thing, the idea that everyone was worried that there was a second departure because Evie and her two friends faked it as if there was.
Did any of you figure out, because they do show you that one shot of them just sitting in the car like in silence,
there are two shots actually,
and then
running naked. That's the
right.
Crazy
that's right that's
yeah
right.
There were definitely like I never thought there was a second departure because
no way.
The show I think was really good about like
setting rules.
Yeah, well that, but like making it believable that some characters would believe there might be a second departure, but never really betraying the fact that like it wasn't gonna happen.
Yeah. Also, the problem with that was that there would be no way of resolving the plot line. So
exactly.
You kind of knew from a story perspective that right. wouldn't.
But like I definitely wouldn't have guessed Guilty Remnant stuff because I think they did a really good job of kind of letting you forget a little bit and letting it feel like a fresh start.
Totally,
because like they did drop like the daughter's friends and they did drop so many characters. They're like, well, maybe they did just drop Liv Tyler. Maybe they did just like move on from this. And so that reveal, at least for me, I thought was so
effective. Was it they open like, the back of like the truck and you see kids in it?
And Liv Tyler turns up as like the most badass motherfucker.
Yeah.
It's like, the scariest Liv Tyler of all time.
So Tommy opens the door in that episode and sees them.
Yeah.
Tommy, the most useless character on the show, by the way.
Yep.
I think if there's a flaw in this show, it's Tommy's entire story.
I enjoy that, you know, I think a lot of people don't like the Guilty Remnant and sort of thought they were a bummer in season one, and then they're like, totally gone. Right, that's their point. And it's really brilliant to make them come back as the ultimate buzzkill, like the ultimate bummer. They're gonna come ruin Miracle, and then right when you're like fuck, they're back, then they just nuke them all and they die, and then they're just not even in season three. I thought that was pretty
solid. Let's talk about season two some more. So we're set, so suddenly the show moves from New York to Miracle, Texas, where there have been no departures, but everybody's still fucked up because in this world nobody is okay.
Also like nobody is okay in any world. It's kind of another
fair. I wasn't gonna go there, but if you
I thought I'd just bring us all down.
I mean, do you want to tell us why the other day at our live show in South by Southwest, someone came, we did a Q&A, and someone was like, can you guys tell us, we've been listening to you guys and hearing your rapport for the past couple of years on the show, can you guys tell us what traits you hate about each other?
It was a really feisty question in the audience. They wanted to start a fight.
I was like, no, we're not going to answer that.
That would be terrible.
I like you're like, we're not going to answer that. And Kirk's like, oh, yeah, we're definitely not going to answer that.
Oh, yeah.
We're not.
Never mind. I like put my notes in my file.
Are you prepared for this?
Yes, we're all broken a little bit.
Yeah, a little bit broken.
But the way, the whole setup is, at first I was like, oh, no, I kind of like that Mapleton, New York. Mm-hmm. Kind of liked being in Westchester, my hometown. But moving to Miracle, I think, was a really smart idea for the show and set up some really interesting things. What did you guys think of the Murphys as a whole, John and Erica and their son, Andrew? What did you think of the Murphys?
I like the Murphys a lot. I like Erica. The way they just like slowly pace out, like you're like, what's she doing with this bird?
Yeah.
There's just so much smart.
So good.
Little, I think I think it frustrated a lot of people. Like, I know people who don't like the show because they see it as like the whole mystery box thing, and they're like, they're making it needlessly complicated. And like, I've definitely like talked to people who feel that way, and I guess I understand it. But for me, like, I love unraveling those mysteries. I love watching how complicated it starts, and then by the end, you're like, oh, like on a rewatch, totally makes sense. Like, none of it feels inauthentic. It's not, I think there are a lot of shows that rely on twists where when you go back and watch it, you're like, oh, well, that's stupid. Why'd he do that if it was going to end up? But like in this show, at least for me, it still totally works.
No,
I think
it checks out perfectly.
Well, the big mystery box in season two is what is in the gift that she gave to her father. And then it turns out it's this metaphor, basically. Here, I got you a metaphor. And that's, I feel like that is the show.
What is the dead cricket a metaphor for?
It's a metaphor for her. She just like wanted him to shut up about it because he was like complaining all the time. And like, isn't that kind of, I mean,
that's what Erica says, right? Like,
she says you wouldn't let it go. Yeah, and he's like, fuck you, Erica. Yeah. And then she leaves. Well, it's like, well, their marriage is over.
Yeah, exactly. That was also like the metaphor for their marriage.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. I do like how the Murphys, it sort of mirrors the Garveys in terms of all of these characters are trying to run away from their problems and their past and their grief. And whether it's by putting physical distance between them or by being like, hey, we're going to have dinner at the dinner table and everything's going to be fine and we're not going to mention any of this. Mm-hmm. And then cut the next scene and he's wrapping cellophane around his head just because to fucking feel something. But I do, and I love the same thing with the Murphys. Like, you assume, you're like, oh, it's this pious dude. He doesn't want swearing at the dinner table. Uh-huh. Like, he goes to church. And then you're like, oh, he also has a sordid past.
Just right. Like, well, and then right after showing that, they show him, like, burning down the dude's house.
Yeah. Well, and then, like, the biggest twist of all in that family is Evie. Because Evie seems like, I remember when she turned up, I was like, this actress is like, she's really like charming on screen. Yes.
And her singing like voice is daughter. Amazing.
Yeah, she's just this wonderful person. Uh-huh. And then of course it turns out, like, what's it? He's basically says, oh, she loves me. My daughter loves me. She loves her family. He's like, maybe she doesn't.
Yeah. Yeah.
And maybe she's super miserable.
And he shoots John. And he shoots
him for it. Yeah.
So in the first episode of season two is revealed that Evie has epileptic seizures and she drops the cake. And she like seizes out there. And after watching it, after watching the whole season, I'm wondering if she was faking that or if she was just doing it to try to like fuck with her family or if that was, because that's never brought up again.
Evie. Sort of a red herring. You're right. You kind of forgotten about that.
Yeah, and you think it helps you think that she disappeared because she had a seizure somewhere or something like
that. Yeah, it's almost interesting because it's like you can look at it as what traditional teenage rebellion would be like in a world where you could completely fuck with people like on a spiritual level. Like, you, instead of just like, oh, they ran away, it's like, no, what if they literally departed? What if they went wherever the rest of the 2% went?
Yeah,
they do this really smart, it gets a little, it never quite falls in like trope territory, but it does do some like thriller-y moments, like like the scene where he has to get like his handprint taken at the fire station and stuff. Like, just feels like it could easily come from like any other murder mystery or something.
Dexter, isn't it? Dexter season two, where he's kind of the walls are closing in on him.
But that's so irrelevant because when that happens, Kevin goes up to John and is like, "Oh, you got the fingerprint, right?
Yeah, right. That's kind of again,
right? It's just a subversion,
and that's why I like it. Like, I think those moments still work really well. I think the whole investigation, like him losing his phone and like that entire thing is like, they just, number one, it makes you buy Kevin and Nora a little bit better at that point because they are like partners in crime. Like, and then when the real shit happens later, it's like they've been through it and you get it, you know? But I think also like Kevin is such a complicated protagonist for the show. Like, there's so much to him that like you kind of hate him, but you follow him, and like there's a lot of like really interesting like anti-hero stuff that he does. But I think knowing he's innocent makes all those scenes play really well.
Yeah.
Like, it's never trying to make you doubt anything.
Right.
Like, it's not trying to trick you into he's an unreliable narrator. It's like, it's never doing that. It's just basically showing you like how far he has to go and like what he's willing to do. And then obviously everything that happens with getting rid of Patty.
Right, so we have to talk about that.
Yeah.
So,
well, there's one thing I want to say before. I feel like we need to get into the afterlife stuff.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Before we do that, really quick, there's one scene in season two that I just want to shout out that's like my favorite scene on this show, and it's a scene where everybody in the Garvey family sits around and they all just like tell all their shit to one another.
Yeah. Yeah.
And they're basically, he's like, a lady died and I buried her in the woods, and she's like, I used to hire prostitutes to shoot me. And like, they all just go down the row, and it feels like the scene that never happened on Lost.
Yeah.
It was extremely on purpose.
Yeah.
And
then being
like, here, everyone's just going to do that.
By
so,
the way,
I love
you said
scene.
You were going to Google the composer, but you never said his name. name?
I didn't Google it yet. Okay, that's
you should get on that. You have like John Williams. 20 minutes left. Yeah. So yes, we got to talk about Kevin Garvey in the afterlife. So some setup here. So throughout season two, Kevin is seeing Patty, the woman from the leader of the Guilty Remnant from season one, who kills herself in front of him, and she is appearing to him, saying all sorts of fucked up
played
stuff
by
to him.
Played by Ann Dowd.
Played by Ann Dowd.
Who is amazing.
Not Margot.
Yeah, not Margot Martindale. Yeah. Right.
No, I would say that by the end of this, Ann Dowd deserves better than being Margot Martindale. She's amazing on this show.
She's amazing in Handmaid's Tale as well.
Yeah. Mm. Oh yeah, she is on that. Yeah. Holy shit! She's I hadn't put that together.
She's an incredible actress.
Of course.
So at first he refuses to acknowledge her, and then she's like, "Fucking talk to me!" Yeah. And eventually he does, and he's trying to figure out how to get her to go away. She drives this wedge between him and Nora. Also, eventually he finds his way into Virgil Murphy, who is his last name might not be Murphy because I think he's Erica's dad.
Yeah, he's Erica's dad,
so we don't know his last name. Maybe it's written down somewhere.
Virgil.
But yeah. Virgil. Yeah.
Virgil.
Yes, a member of the family who is a who winds up telling him that in order to get rid of Patty, he has to die and go to the afterlife and kill her. And there's all sorts of crazy stuff that happens there. There's all sorts of questions of like whether Virgil is to be believed, whether he's trying to trap Kevin, and there's some deception there too.
Mm-hmm. I mean, the moment after that's all being set up, when like Kevin goes under
and
like
kills himself
and then he shoots
oh no,
like I think that in a show
well he gets rid of the antidote, right?
Yeah,
there was supposed to be something that he was getting,
and he breaks and kills himself.
Yeah.
in a show full of shocking moments, I genuinely think that's like one of the only times it's like, oh shit.
Yeah,
like,
wow.
Well, because you also assume just like his name is like so on the nose, they're like, oh, this is gonna be his guide into the underworld and everything, and then he kills himself. You're like, oh no, that's not this.
Yeah.
So I want to ask everybody a question.
Okay,
maybe to preface this conversation.
Go.
Do you think that the afterworld stuff, either in the season or in the next, anytime this stuff is referenced, did it really happen? Is it real, Andrew? Maybe.
I say yes.
I mean, I say that as
someone who absolutely doesn't believe in God or the afterlife in real
life.
But
in this show, I mean, in the show.
Like, in the show, I absolutely think
by afterworld, you mean like the
when he goes to the
international
hotel.
Assassin.
Yeah, any of that.
I mean, they have to, because the thing he sees with his dad in around the Aboriginals, right?
It's real.
So, like,
so there's not a chance.
I don't think
that,
it's ambiguous.
You don't think there's a chance that he? Oh, I think it's ambiguous. There's a chance that it's in his head that he had some kind of a crazy
experience.
I think
it all happens for sure, because he sees, not only does he see his dad, he sees God, the guy calling himself God in season three.
Yeah.
He like meets
even that. So I think that in shows like this, there's a thing that a show does when it really wants you to know that something's real, and this show doesn't quite do it with that. There's always some way that they could figure out for it not to be real. I agree. I think it's totally real too. Like, I buy into it, and I think it's like a total moment. I bet everybody does who watches it. Mm-hmm. But I do like how...
You don't think the fact that he kills Patty and then Patty goes away is that...
No, it could be him dealing with his own psychosis in some way.
All right, sure.
I think you could totally... I totally buy that somebody somewhere who's far smarter than I am, who picks up in details far better,
could
make a good argument for why it isn't real.
Sure.
Like, because like, especially this stuff like seeing the same faces and stuff like that totally feels like it could be hallucinations.
Exactly. There isn't like a thing where he changes something in the dream that then changes in the real world. That doesn't do the thing that a lot of this kind of fiction does, where it really indicates, oh, there was a real connection.
Well, I think,
you know,
what makes it, why I love that, why I love that my answer to that question is yes. The reason I think that's so artfully done is because in season one, I'm like, oh, his dad's a fucking nut job.
Yeah.
But then in season two, when you go to this hotel and see all this stuff happen, you're like, oh, like his dad was also probably authentically seeing. Like, I find that side of it really interesting. The way.
And then you get to season three and it turns out he's actually.
Yeah.
I think the way Kevin Sr. changes is one of the most fascinating things in the show for me, even though that's not a character I particularly love.
He's an asshole.
Like, watching him change is super fascinating.
So let's talk about that episode. So season two, episode eight, is called International Assassin.
Yeah.
Yes.
That's the full title, right?
Yeah.
And it is a trip. It is sort of like Tony Soprano's coma sequence where he's Kevin Finnerty in The Sopranos, just cranked up to 11, because it's just like also like Kevin Garvey is his job is to assassinate presidential candidate Patty.
It's funny, it's almost like an inverse of The Sopranos thing, because in The Sopranos thing he's just an ordinary dude, and you know, on The Leftovers he's a guy who goes and kills people, where Tony goes and kills people and is not
that's true. That's true. It is funny. In The Sopranos it's meant to be purgatory, and it's like his chance to redeem himself rather than going to hell. But in this, it's more, it's just straight up the afterlife of this hotel.
So I love that the afterlife is just this shitty hotel. It was like the cheapest shoot for them to do possible. Yeah. They're like, some hotel in Vancouver.
I think it's
a nice hotel, but I mean, it's not what dreams may come.
There's nothing magical about it. It's just like a modernly designed hotel.
Pretty good karaoke bar.
Yeah, sure.
Not wrong.
And of course, Kevin Garvey has to sing the second time he winds up there in order to get out. But the first time he has to kill Patty, and there's just all sorts of shit that they throw in there. Everything from dead characters reappearing, like Wayne as a security guard for Patty, and what's her face? The girl who died, Gladys, is that her name, or something else? The woman.
The Guilty Remnant lady.
Yeah, the Guilty Remnant. Yeah. I forget her name, is slipping me, but she's there. And they just have all sorts of... So that episode was actually controversial to some people. Some people did not like it. I assume that all of us in this room loved it to death.
A fantastical dream sequence on an HBO show that fans didn't like. I can't imagine that ever happening.
I feel like that, to me, is on a short list of what I consider to be perfect episodes. I absolutely love that episode.
What did you love about it?
Oh, man. I mean, like, everything you just said and, like, just how surreal it is on a show that, like... So the show does a really good job of setting up these mysteries that then have fairly mundane explanations. Like, it does give you an explanation, but this brings it all the way back to, like, never mind. Like, everything is just nuts. Yep. And I think the way it makes Kevin kind of confront everything he's going through, like, because he thinks he's going there to just get rid of Patty, but it's so much more than that. Yeah. Like, it builds in so much more of his past. And, like, I like the way it's unfolding because, like, even things like Don't Drink the Water and, like, the little tiny details in it are just so smart. Like, I really like the Patty body double thing. Yeah. Like, it's like, there's just so many, like, weird moments in that episode that just make it, like, I will never forget it.
Sure. Right. Him opening his wardrobe and seeing, like, every face of his wife. Options. Yeah.
Exactly.
So he kills the doppelganger, a body double of Patty, and then it turns out the little girl in the room next to him is actually Patty, and she's with her husband, and through that we can see, like, why she is the way she is.
Yeah. Well, and it's so, like, it perfectly captures what a dream is like, you know, like it has those moments of, like, you see one thing and then you kind of blink and it's something different, you know, and it, like, means something different. And, like, even things like the scene of him going into the bathroom to get the gun that's supposed to be there, it captures what it's like to have a dream more than almost anything I've ever seen in another show or film.
I watched that scene completely out of context in a hotel once when I was just staying there, and I turned it on and I was like, I don't know what this is. And it was literally right then he goes into the bathroom to get the gun, and I was like, what the fuck am I watching? Yeah. And then I saw it was The Leftovers, and I was like, I'll probably watch this show. I changed the channel, but that was all I saw. And then later I watched it, I was like, oh, I remember this. That was totally
weird. Hey, Kirk,
weird.
How's that Googling going?
It's good. The composer is named Max Richter.
Shout out to Max Richter.
Andy's brother, I'm sure.
Yes.
So, and then that episode, Kevin has to throw a little girl down a well.
So harrowing. What a fucked up scene.
And then he just does it.
Cold-blooded. I guess it's like, would you kill Hitler as a baby?
Yeah, that shot is so
good. Yeah, just like Hitler.
That shot is like a slightly extended shot that just lingers on the two of them. And then after like 5 seconds, he just pushes her.
Yeah.
And it's just like
a no.
Just
like, bam, gotta get it over with, gotta do it. And then he goes down the well to finish her off. And she's suddenly adult Patty, begging for her life and crying.
I really, that scene hit me really hard. And then when he goes back, like, for 1 second when I watched the finale for the very first time and he goes back to that world, I was like, oh, don't cheapen it. But then, like, I love the karaoke sequence.
I think it's
sort of like, watching him, it almost weirdly reminds me of Groundhog Day when, like, he's to the point where he's like, all right, let's just get through it. Like, you know, like, seeing him, like, oh, goddamn, and he puts on the cop uniform. And
he looks in the mirror and he's like, motherfucker.
Motherfucker. Well, and it really is, like, it's the real life version of dying and realizing the checkpoint is like,
Sorry,
I had to bring a video game.
No, it's good.
That is great when he comes back. Did you know that there's a theory, by the way, if we're going to talk about the finale, how he gets the dog and then the dog runs away? There's a theory that the people were turned into dogs, that all the people.
What?
Yeah.
Which
apparently.
The Leftovers.
Yeah. There's and a Leftovers departures. Theory that everyone who departed became back as a dog.
And that's why the season one guy is killing the dogs.
But and there's the some of the dogs.
Wait, is no one like, why? Where did this $140 million
dogs
come from?
They seem like they know us.
I think all theories are out the window because they tell you what happens at the end of the show.
I don't think
we'll get to that.
You were so confident on this, but I just.
The reason I say that is because I read an interview with Damon Lindelof. We're skipping ahead a little bit here. But he said that the way they came up with that is that. Way at the beginning when they were first shooting the pilot, he told Peter Berg the director of the pilot, let's shoot a scene from the baby's perspective in the very first scene. And instead of the baby disappearing, the mother disappears from the baby's perspective. And because they didn't have time, they were like burning daylight. So they didn't have time to actually shoot that. But that idea got stuck in his head. And he was thinking the entire time that that's what happened.
I saw Tony Allen realize Peter Berg directed the pilot.
Yes, he... Maybe he didn't direct it, or maybe he was... I think he directed it, actually. Yes, I think he was Hancock. In it. He was in it. He was Wayne's security guard.
I always think of him as Mr. Wayne. Friday Night Lights.
Yeah, exactly.
He always directs pilots and then pieces out and leaves it to some guard.
Same with J.J.
He's like J.J. Abrams. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. All right, let's get into season three. So season two ends with Kevin goes back to the afterlife and the guilty remnant put on this crazy riot where they convince everybody that there's a bomb, that they're going to blow up the bridge to Miracle. And it turns out that they have these plants within the camp outside of Miracle, the crazy camp that we get to see all throughout the season. And then they lead them all into Miracle and just cause this great riot.
I think that, we don't have a timeline exactly for how this stuff works. I feel like it escalates a little bit quickly.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Like, I think that there's the fact that he walks in and there's like two people like fucking on the ground.
Yeah.
Like,
well, so the
and there's like fire
quickly.
Everywhere. And
you're
it's
like, how
like,
long
I was like,
have
wow,
you been gone
yeah,
for?
This really
right.
escalated.
Well, so what happens is we see what happens in real life, and then we cut to the afterlife for a while.
Yeah.
And so after that, presumably,
like, how long would it take for things to escalate?
Well, how
to
much
that
time
level?
Do you think passed? It seems like a few hours.
I'm not really sure.
I mean, but it seems like that's for it to escalate in a few hours.
It's like
pretty
fully
crazy.
A riot. People are having an orgy.
Daylight to nighttime, so it could be 8 hours.
I mean, it's a minor nitpick. It is something that kind of like sticks out to me.
I can destroy a town.
The other thing
hours.
You got to consider is that these people in the camp were all fucked up people. Yeah. They were all doing some crazy shit.
Yeah,
like,
fair.
These are people who are like, remember?
Hedonistic Hooverville.
Yeah.
I'm still a little unconvinced.
Remember
even
the
ones,
priest
whatever.
Episode where sure, he makes him paddle the dude?
I know. Yeah, I know.
It's even the people, who seem a little more normal from that camp, like the resentment of Miracle.
Yes.
Like, they want to go up there and fuck stuff up.
I get it.
That
I just,
would happen quickly.
It's sticks out to me as a little bit.
But anyway, all. So all that happens.
Not convinced.
And
it's
then
expedited.
Season two.
Yeah. For sure.
Season two, just like all the seasons ended on this really optimistic note. Season two ends with him getting back to his house and the camera pans and everybody's there. And Nora's like, "You're home." And that's it. It's just a smile.
I love
Kevin's
that line.
Face.
That line delivery.
So yeah, for such a depressing show, I feel like every single season has ended on the most.
I don't think it's a depressing show. I think it's an uplifting
show. For a
show
that deals with depression so much.
It's a show really, about depressing things more than it's a depressing show.
An uplifting show about depressing things.
Yeah.
That should have been the tagline. Yeah. That's how you get people to watch.
So all throughout season two, they're talking about Australia. And as I was watching it, I kind of knew in my head that they would wind up in Australia, not with having read this beforehand, but just hearing Australia over and over.
Rewatching it, because I rewatched it right before season three came, and I knew it was set in Australia, and so I was kind of like noting every time they saw Australia, and they say it almost once per episode, like, because like he gives the letter from the guy on the top of the tower, and that's going to Australia, and obviously like Kevin's dad is in Australia, and there's so many little references to it. They talk about like, oh, I heard there's a guy in Australia who can't die.
You know,
like,
if you take the first letter of the first line of every episode, it spells Australia.
Is that actually true?
No.
I
just made that up right now.
International stuff.
Yeah, well, Better Call Saul does that with episodes. Yeah,
maybe it does. Maybe it does. It sounds good.
I think in second season of Better Call Saul, they had it spell out like Gus Fring is back or something.
I thought you were going to say spoiler, but yeah, that's the spoiler.
Well, whatever. Oh, yeah, Breaking Bad characters are going to show up in Better Call Saul. So season three starts, and immediately it starts off with the crazy scene from the 1800s with, what is it, the Millerites?
The Millerites,
which I like as much as the caveman scene. Like,
I like it more.
Like, I think that sequence of just like the message about faith that has been persistent throughout the entire series up to that point, and like her just like, even when like her husband and her child are, you know, move on and like don't believe in it, she keeps going.
Well, I feel like, and it's more on. It's less of a WTF than the cave woman.
Yes.
Just because it's clearly like thematically on point with the show. You're like, I see what you're saying. Okay.
Yes. So great. Season three begins. It seems like everything's normal. 3 years have passed, and Kevin and Nora are living together. They seem to have a healthy, happy relationship, except for the fact that Kevin is like
neither of them are happy nor healthy.
And suddenly John Murphy is married to Lori Garvey, which is wild.
That was
like running scams on people.
Well, running scams and then shredding all the money. It's all very bizarre.
Yeah.
Eventually we make our way to Australia because Nora finds out from one of the leads of Perfect Strangers that there's a machine that can send her to wherever the departed people are. When you guys saw that, did you believe that it was actually going to happen? It was actually going to work?
No, just given how every, like, that show never gave Nora happiness, I assumed it would end still with her just never finding happiness nervous. And getting, like, duped once again by whatever this, yes. this Ponzi yeah. scheme
Oh, man,
was.
I should agree. Say, I forgot to mention in the first episode, even before we find out about that, the first episode ends with her, with, like, that insane scene of her, like, old Nora
oh, yeah.
being asked if she knows someone named Kevin yeah, and yeah. saying no, and that leads to all sorts of questions.
I was yeah. so confused with that. I was like, what oh, the my God. Fuck?
Yeah.
Where
that
is this
was
going?
Like a lost ish.
Oh, totally,
moment.
Yeah.
Oh, that is 100%. Lost. That is probably the most lost moment in the show, in yes. my opinion.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah I like... you know, I don't know. I love the first whatever 3-4 episodes. Like my real opinions about season 3 come later because
yes,
like
that's when the real stuff starts.
I
they
really
don't even get
love...
to Australia until like episode 4.
Yeah, yeah, and I like the Australia episode. Like for me, well, I don't know. We'll get to it when we get later. There's a I think it's the third to last episode is one of my only true complaints about the entire show.
Which
one
episode
of the
is that?
Dislike. It's the Lori focused one.
Okay, so the one where you think she killed herself
yeah.
at the end.
And that's oh, my yeah. biggest complaint about the entire show is that I wish she had killed herself.
Yeah,
because I think
really
it is,
I don't agree.
It is the most perfect goodbye possible.
So, and oh like, man, sorry.
Was,
finish your thought.
Well, I just I think it's such a clean, good ending to and like getting the phone call from the kids and like I love that ending so much that like in the finale when Nora called mm-hmm. her,
yeah.
I was like. Fuck. Like, I was yeah. really, so, I, like,
oh man.
I
so,
feel like.
Wait. So, but my yeah. reaction was the exact opposite. I loved that she was back alive because, man, I thought it was such a feeling of relief. And I feel like it was so on point with the way that this show operates, where it makes you feel this, like, sad, ultra despair. And then at the end, it tells you, no, it's going to be okay. And kind of the one thing that characters don't really do on this show, obviously some smaller characters notwithstanding, is kill themselves. There's yeah. so much suicidal ideation in this show. There's yeah. so many times where people think about killing themselves. Kevin Garvey's like trying to kill himself the entire show.
Yeah.
There's this whole episode where you're like, is Lori going to kill herself? And then you really think she does at the end, and it's this heartbreaking ending. And then they're like, she didn't. She didn't yeah. kill herself.
So yeah. I interpret that and as the phone call from her kids convinced her not to kill herself.
No, that's
yeah. oh yeah, of course. Yeah, yeah. That's right. Okay.
But
no,
it's
yeah,
like
I
think it's one of those like on a rewatch, it like because that moment like Leftovers made me cry a lot. That mm-hmm. moment when you just hear her go into the water, yeah. like. Yeah. I just sobbed. Like that was mm-hmm. like so effective. And I think part of why I don't like that it wasn't real, that it was a fake out essentially, is that like on a rewatch, it just robs it of that weight for me.
Yeah.
And I think like I like Lori. I genuinely do. I like that actress a lot. And like I think they're like man, do I like her more in season 3 than I did in like seasons 1 and 2. Like oh, yeah. I just really like
her
by the end.
She talks more.
Yeah, yeah. That's part of it. Yeah. It's funny how that can help you be more endeared to a character. But no, I think it's that. I think it's like that moment hit me as hard as anything in the show. And like, I know that rewatching that episode, it can never have that same effect. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm, mm-hmm. So that's part of it.
So yeah, so season 3, so episode 2 is the Perfect Stranger stuff. Episode 3, we go hang out with Kevin Garvey Sr. for a while in Australia. That I actually thought was the weakest episode of the
bunch.
Is that
crazy white fellow thinking?
Yes, yeah. Because he's just going and doing insane things. And he's not a very likable character, I feel like, yeah. in the show.
I like the episode after that a lot. I like where it led. And like I like him yeah. being where he ends up. And yeah. then, and like... Man, the guy, what is the question? The guy who pulls it in the car and it's like they ask me yes or no or whatever.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. Like, I think that stuff's really effective. Mm-hmm. But I agree. I think the weak steps of the season is that.
I like that those ladies just kill that random guy.
The
yeah.
random,
random
cop
named
yeah.
Kevin.
Yeah.
And then he's just dead.
Yeah. Ooh, that's
well, so the big red herring throughout this season is the book of Kevin, because yeah. you are led to believe that they are like actually like worshipers
are
maybe
you?
In the future.
I mean, I feel like by that point, I was not led to believe anything. Every time something like that came up and I was like, oh, maybe this will be a thing. Oh yeah, no, it won't be because yeah. like yeah. this is not how this show operates. At
no,
that point,
but,
I very well, much was.
But the thing is, they set you up with this belief that Nora is in the future, so maybe that has something to do with the book of Kevin, and then maybe these other people are involved with that. That was my thinking.
Oh, yeah. No, I was... yeah, I was.
But regardless, this whole... The running that. Theme of this entire season is more religious than any of the others, mm-hmm. because Kevin, after finding out that Kevin died and came back, Matt has been writing this book
of course,
called The Book
Matt,
of Kevin, and there's this running question of whether Kevin Garvey is actually Jesus Christ,
yeah.
which
yeah.
is... Good question, I would say.
If you die and come back, yeah, that's
solid question.
Yeah. I think Kevin's reaction to the book
is so good.
It's so fucking good. Funny. Yeah. Like, I just, I don't know. I think Justin Theroux is so good in this show. And
he
like,
is.
He's surrounded by so many incredible performances that I think I would occasionally forget that he too, because like there's some episodes where he's just kind of one note, but like there are a lot of times where he like has these like powerhouse moments. You're like, oh yeah, you're
really singing good. Singing Paul Simon.
Yeah, seriously.
I mean,
Jesus. Very good. Yeah, and anything with him and Nora, they have such good chemistry that I think makes the show work.
Their fight in that hotel room.
So their fight. Oh my God. So one of the most devastating moments in the entire show, one of the most devastating moments in TV ever, is that scene where everything comes out, all the tensions come to a head, and they are just fighting. I believe that's at the end of season 3, episode 4, where they're fighting, and then he just pieces out and gets in the van with his dad.
Her eyes.
That shot is just iconic. Yeah. That shot of her crying and like,
I wanted to. It was. I was getting sad, so I thought I'd make a joke.
Good job. Good job. And yeah, and that is essentially set up for the payoff of the finale of the series, which is the next time they see each other is, what, 30 years later, 40 years later? So before we get to that, a couple more things. First of all, the next episode is Matt focused, and it's them on the cruise boat, which is absolutely insane.
What was the name of the lion?
That episode.
I kept thinking of Cecil the Lion, but that's the lion.
No, but it's not. I remember, though. It's a ridiculous
name.
Just
Google it. I will. But yes, he is. There are a bunch of hedonists who have orgies.
That's such a weird episode.
And believe that the lion is God. And then there's actual God. What did you guys make of God, the guy calling himself God who can't die? Do you think he has the same powers as Kevin?
Yeah. I don't know. Like, I didn't know. On kind of the higher level of like, is he full of shit or not? I was less like, for me, I think that actor is really, really good. Yes. And I love what they did with like him making, like, I like that he even shakes Matt, you know, like that to me, like works really well. I don't know. I guess I've never really thought about if I have an answer to.
So remember, this is the same guy. Kirk didn't actually pick this up. What are you laughing at?
I'm laughing that the lion's name is Frasier.
Frasier. That was it.
So Kirk didn't pick up.
I like that you're going to like out me for missing
Kirk
something.
Kirk didn't pick up on this.
Thanks, Jason.
Until we watched it again last night.
Yeah, but that guy who asked me the thing that I don't like about you, it was that you pointed that out.
So God, the guy who plays God is also in the afterlife scenes, and he's the one who tells Kevin to sing karaoke, and he's the one who puts a noose on him on the bridge.
So it's funny that, so you mentioned
it would be easy not to make that connection.
Well, the thing is, you mentioned not getting it, but it's because I didn't watch the show in a space where I was even trying to make it.
It's not, kind of actually easy like to not get that connection.
Illustrates the,
I had to like double check by Googling it, and I had just watched it all.
Thanks, buddy. That makes me feel better. Buddy.
Yeah, whatever. It's not a big deal. You don't get offended at that. But anyway, so
I'm a little upset.
So that I think that like adds evidence to the theory that he actually is able to go into the afterlife and then come back and be God. I assume the fact that he can't die means that he does have the same powers that Kevin Garvey has.
This is all like not, I don't know, like don't the whole thing of like people having about? Powers and like who has the same powers, like is Iron Man stronger in his suit than Captain America? Like it feels to
me
like
obviously
not.
Iron Man could be Cap. Well, I feel like,
I don't know, I think Cap is stronger.
Yeah, and I mean it depends. I mean,
don't they literally fight in Civil War? Yeah, I guess he has Winter Soldier with him too.
And also they could, yeah, neither of them kind
I
of.
Regret I regret bringing this up. But anyway, you know what I mean? Like, I feel like the minute you're trying to figure out who has like what God powers and stuff,
yeah,
it's like not really the
I
level.
Just find it interesting to ask, like, is he God? Is he not God? Why
I've never thought about,
God?
Does Kevin have powers? Like, right. I didn't.
Is he actually special?
Right? Yeah, well, that's
one of the questions that season 3 asks.
I guess, but could anyone,
well, the whole idea of him stopping the flood—that's what's really interesting about season 3 is that it sets up the idea that they were all just deluded and never actually led to anything. There was no fucking flood.
Yeah,
yeah.
The gun. I have trouble with the gunshot wound. I still think maybe he took some poison that lowered his blood pressure for like 8 hours, and then he came out from underground.
That's so funny.
And then,
like you're still
trying
to figure out.
I don't think that, but like there's that possibility. And like the gunshot is super weird because he should definitely die, and you're watching this kind of impossible thing, but then it's not impossible, and it makes sense because the whole show is predicated on an impossible thing that happened.
Yeah,
and so like faith. Sure, yeah, like, yeah, but like, you kind of just have to. You're like, well, he's walking around, like he seems fine, and so yeah, there that is an ongoing question. Is sort of.
I mean, I read like the scrawling of a madman Reddit post of like the 8,000 word theory about how like everything that happens after that gunshot wound is is fantasy, and he's dead in Miracle. Ugh. And like there's like,
you know, Kirk wrote that.
Yeah, that was under my pen name. Leftovers truther.
Exactly. There are definitely people like I am positive someone has posited a believable theory that you know, that obviously like it's not real and that none of that happened. But I think The theme of season three that I think makes especially like the big question, the big like is Nora telling the truth or not question, is that theme of lying. Like I think season three has so much to do with like who's telling the truth and who isn't, and or who thinks they're telling the truth but isn't seeing reality, like when he sees Evie and stuff like that. So it's like I think that sort of, unlike what I said in season two, I do think season three does kind of fuck with you as far as like, well, who is reliable here, and like who sees things as they really are, and who, you know, it goes back to even like it's so thematically perfect, and it bookends it really well because it makes me think a lot of my experiences in season one being like, is Wayne bullshit or is it like some kind of psychosomatic, like it just makes people feel better in the moment or something.
Yeah. So so we have the boat episode, then we have the Lori episode, and then we have Kevin going back into the afterlife for a third time to deal with his twin brother. Andrew, you seem very excited about that episode.
I think both of us, like I I've rambled about International Assassin, so you can take this
Marty,
if you
take
want,
us but... away.
No, wait, this wait, was totally...
Us, talk about it.
It was the most important man in the world and his identical twin brother. Again, just like International Assassin, that second dip into the surreal when... it keeps throwing weird shit, and when it's like, you need to use your penis in order to enter this door. Yes. And I'm like, all right, I'm on board. I'm still on board.
Wasn't that a joke? I feel like I read somewhere that was a joke because there was some paparazzi shot of Justin throw them and it looked like he had
it. It's not the paparazzi. It's the jogging scenes in season one.
Oh, okay.
Like,
and you can't see the life of his art.
I love his framing.
He was on Jimmy Kimmel or something, and they the entire interview was just about his dick, and like it became like a running joke on the set.
I wonder who made the sound effect for his dick like flumping onto the
thing. Is so funny. It's like basically sounds flumps. Like dropping a full steak on a countertop. Yeah.
You're like, wow,
so good.
Okay.
So good.
Yeah, bring it back. Bringing back Anne. Like that's like bringing back those characters, and then honestly, that final confrontation that he has with himself. Like, I can't imagine what it's like to act opposite yourself and to do it that well.
Yeah.
Like that's like those two episodes to me. Like he has to carry so many of those scenes by himself, which is such an incredible thing. Like a thing for me. Like doing it with like Carrie Coon totally makes sense because I'm like, this is a just AAA actress. Like and so she almost makes it easy. Whereas doing this by yourself seems impossible. Uh-huh. And yet he's able to do it. Like, and that I don't know, those final moments are just like absolutely incredible.
That freaks me out. Like on The Deuce or on Wolf in Black. Like whenever actors do that, I'm like, how, what the fuck?
I mean, even like what a stupid example, but like even like Armie Hammer in Social Network, like even like the Winklevoss twins.
Wait, also, we totally glossed over, which episode begins with the dude on the submarine? The naked dude. Was it that one?
Yeah.
The naked dude on the submarine.
Yeah, because
that's all about like the launch codes. And
Well, and like they're really smart about it because in the episode where they have the big fight, when he leaves the hotel, they talk about how like there was an explosion or like
that's referring to
that guy launching that. Yeah.
Does anything ever come of that, or like is that ever brought up again? I don't remember.
I think it was just an accident, or it was like a thing that happened.
Right.
It did happen. But it's not a major plot point, but like the characters on the show.
They do explain it. I forget what it is, but
they're like fucks up travel, right? It's like there was like a bomb.
And that's why flights are grounded.
Okay, so does that keep the characters in Australia? Or is that why Matt needs to take the boat?
It's why Matt needs to take the boat.
Yeah.
And it's also because episode four ends, you find out that there's been an accident or whatever, and then episode five is the boat. Is that what it is? Mm-hmm. So it's like, I think also there is a throwaway line. I think it's in the finale or maybe even in this episode where they're like, oh yeah, some crazy guy hijacked it. Like they do explain it away, and there isn't like more significance to it, if I remember right.
Right.
Yeah.
Is the line that his twin says to him, is it like, we really fucked up with Nora?
Yes.
And
it's kind of him realizing, right? Like, oh, this is the most important thing.
Well,
she's
so that's the
thing.
So the setup of that is that they're trying to, because dad is trying to prevent the flood, and there's supposed to be a flood on the day of the departure. I think it would be 7 years afterwards or something like that. Or 7 years. And so he has to blow up the entire afterlife at a certain point. What's the logic behind him? I don't even remember. What's the logic behind him starting that nuclear war to blow up the entire afterlife? Because I know that what happens is from then on, he can no longer go back there.
Yeah.
And so if he dies, he'll die for real. I don't remember why he did it. Do you guys remember why he did it? I know Patty wanted him to do it. I think he was trying, because he wasn't able to get the song. He spoke to the dude with the song, was the prime minister of another country.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
And then
I'm not sure. I don't remember.
Imagine someone
describing this as just so
finding this podcast randomly and like yeah. that was the kid just
hilarious. Scrub to this
in
moment. Actually,
like in Australia, was it the character with the song fell off his roof?
Yeah.
Oh yeah. Off the ladder. Yeah.
He just dies.
And he just dies. Yeah.
I honestly like this is where it's funny because I've seen season 1 and 2 enough that I remember them really vividly. But weirdly 3 I haven't rewatched anything yet, so it's like
the important part is that afterwards, after this, he winds up being so driven to find Nora that, as we find out a little bit later in the next episode, that he has spent the past whatever, however many years traveling to Australia
just
on vacation.
Just going door to door, basically,
and just
right?
Scouring the countryside, the entire friggin' country for her. So let's get to that. So obviously, Nora's entire plotline throughout the season is that she has this ability or is looking into this ability that the scientists built this machine that will supposedly take her to wherever the departed went. And she's just haunted by this thought of seeing her kids again and going back there. At the end of the day, we see her wrestle with the thought whether or not to go, wrestle with the decision. Then we see her strip down at the beginning of the series finale and walk down this tunnel in this like super haunting shot of her just naked walking down this tunnel, get in this tub. And then as she is being submerged in the machine, cut to black.
Well,
no
she starts to say
there.
Something, yes. And we don't know what.
She starts,
so
opens
there's
her mouth.
First of all, there's an interview that everyone should read with Carrie Coon that Alan Sepinwall did on his blog. I don't know if any of you have read it.
Yes.
It's incredible. And I know you read it, that's right. And she talks about how they shot this scene. And apparently that scene, it was just her and Christopher Eccleston. I think they were the only actors left. Everybody else had left. It was the last thing they shot on the show, even though it wasn't obviously the last shot of the show. And so she's alone, and she had to go do this really difficult shot where she's naked and in this cold room. Plus, it's like the most sci-fi the show goes by super far. Like it looks like, you know, alien kind of stuff. And just it's a great interview, and her talking about how to do that scene and how they talked her through it and the whole process of it really felt like the end of the world because the show was ending and everyone had left, and here she was all alone, and she was really alone, and Nora's so alone. It's a great interview in general.
So, so like you talk about that moment where she starts to say something, and then you talk about ambiguity, and it's like,
oh man,
just what she's saying, because they're like, if you want us to stop, we can stop anytime, just say so. Like there's like so much stop. Like the buildup is so smart because like it really could be either. Like you totally can buy that she ended it and never went through with it and made everything up, or it all really happened. Like, and the evidence is like, man, like I read obsessively, like I probably did read that Sepinwall interview at some point because I was like, just I could not read
she
it.
She says
enough.
She knows. I think they didn't tell her. The showrunners have their own idea of whether it's true or not. They didn't tell her, but she has her. She made up her mind and knows what she thinks happened, like whether Nora's telling the truth or not. But she'll never tell anyone.
So wait,
either.
So we'll get to that. Let me just do a little more recapping. So the next thing we see after that is the flash forward that we had seen at the beginning of the season, which is old Nora. She's doing her thing. Suddenly, she's approached by Kevin Garvey. Kevin Garvey pretends that they only met once and didn't have to go through everything. There's a whole bunch of back and forth between the two of them.
Yeah, this whole weird
wedding, a wedding where they put everybody's sins on a goat in the form of beads and then send the goat out as a scapegoat. Lots of stuff that we won't recap the whole thing, but long or short of it is Nora and Kevin have this sit down, and Nora tearfully tells Kevin that she went into the machine, she went into the afterlife. Turns out that all of the departed people were in their own world where everybody else had departed. And in that version, in that after Earth B, I believe people call it, her family were the lucky ones because they only lost her and she didn't, they got to stay together. So everybody else had lost the majority of their family, but they only lost one person. So she says she sees them. She realizes that they're happy without her. She goes and talks to the scientist who built the machine in the first place, somehow gets him to build a new machine to send her back to Earth A. And then goes and lives in the Australian outback and is too afraid to go find Kevin. And it turns out Kevin has been scouring the earth looking for her. And then we end on the question of her saying she was afraid that Kevin wouldn't believe her. Kevin saying, of course I believe you. You're here. And that's how. And then we end zooming out, seeing pigeons departing. I see you're all about to cry, even just from the description of this. I don't blame you. I teared up quite a bit after that scene. Kirk, why don't we start with you? Tell us what you thought of those final moments of The Leftovers.
I thought the final.
And did you believe her?
I believe. I don't believe her. I mean, I believe Nora, but I don't think that she traveled through to a parallel reality. I don't think that that's the case. I think So Nora says, I don't lie, right? That's Nora's whole thing. Yeah. And like throughout the season, she's like, I don't lie. But she's kind of lying a lot throughout the entire season. There are plenty of instances
she lies
of her
all the time.
Deceiving people and lying all the time. She's lying to herself.
She lies to herself.
And that's kind of like the ultimate lie, is that she was lying to herself. She lied to herself that she was okay. She lied to herself about everything, like with so many different people. Mm-hmm. And she wasn't okay. And I think she probably didn't go through with it. There are just so many logistical questions. It gets up into like, if there was a scientist there who could send people back, why didn't he send other people through? And
right.
and all this dumb shit that I think is like totally beside the point. So I don't think that she is telling the truth, but I do think that she's telling like a truth, right? This is maybe a corny thing to say, but she is, right? So there's a scene earlier with the nun where she talks to the nun and they're talking about these pigeons being sent out to like spread messages of love to everybody. Mm-hmm. And then the nun sort of says, well, I don't know if that's really the case, but that's the nicer story. Something right. along those lines. Like, that's the better story.
Right.
And I think that's a super important line, obviously. And then later, she tells the nicer story. She tells this version where like the people that we lost are somewhere and they're together. And like her family is together. Mm-hmm. And that's kind of her coping with them. There's also a super crucial scene that I'm not totally sure what it means. Maybe you guys have your takes on it, but after the wedding, so they get together at the wedding and she kind of buys into this fiction for just a second, this lie. Mm-hmm. And she's with Kevin and she's just happy and they're dancing. It's really beautiful, a beautiful looking, beautiful scene. And then she's like, no, like this is, fuck this, like this isn't real, you're not
right.
real
right.
She runs away and then
she
finds the goat.
Believe a lie. Yeah. Which...
exactly. And then she finds the goat and the goat has all the beads and is like, the beads are caught up in this fence and the goat is like suffering. She takes the beads off, saves the goat, puts the beads on, takes everybody's sins on herself, looks at the goat. Okay, this is like, I don't know what the scene means exactly. Yeah. Like, I'm not sure. Do any of you have a read on the goat scene? What does it mean?
No, I love the scene, but I'm totally in the same boat where I'm just
I'm like, okay, I see the symbols. I just can't.
So my whole interpretation of this finale is, and like, I really want it to be real so badly, but I don't think it's real. And like
the world beads.
The alternate universe thing. Because I think like, the whole season does say, with Kevin, with the nun sleeping with the guy, with the that exact line that you bring up, but it's a nicer story, which is also true of the goat, I think. Mm-hmm. Like, I just think she is in such denial about, like, falsehoods and about, like, this idea that, like, people could represent themselves as something other than what they are. And it's, like, sort of reads to me like a self-hatred thing. It's, like, mm-hmm. that she knows she's lying both to herself and other people. And that's why, like, at the end... like, I think you absolutely nailed it, Kirk. Like, I think it's like she believes what she is saying, but I don't think it occurred. And I think it's like so heartbreaking because of that. And because Kevin, in that moment, he absolutely will believe it for the rest of his life. He will never doubt it. He will never. And like,
it's kind of lovely though, right? Because he's saying, I believe you. Like, I believe in you. Right, I love you. Like, and what really matters is that I'll believe anything you say because you're Nora.
And like, Nora, like, her whole arc in the entire show is that she needs closure. And like, the whole nature of the departure is she will never fucking get closure. And so she, maybe to her detriment, needed that story and needed it to be real. And the only one who would have known is Matt, and he's dead from cancer at this point. So it's like there's no one who can say this, you know, this isn't true. And so I think, like, God, that nature of what a lie is and how a lie can hurt somebody versus that exact line. You know, it reminds me of The Sopranos, like, just to momentarily diverge, of like the most important line in The Sopranos, if you believe the correct theory of what the ending of that show means, is Tony in the boat having that conversation about death.
Bobby.
And it's like, it just goes black.
Yeah.
Like, it just cuts to black. And that so obviously is, like, anyone who thinks it's not is crazy, in my opinion, because it's so obviously foreshadowing.
Let's
what
save
happened.
This for The Sopranos.
For our other HBO series. Yeah. But I think for me, that's exactly what that line
the same
is.
Line,
it's that same thing of, like, that is the closest they come to telling you what the case is, which is that, like, it's just a nicer story.
Uh-huh, yeah. Uh-huh. Well, and also, I think just from I totally agree with both of you. I think just from a filmmaking standpoint, the fact that she delivers this entire thing in a monologue, in a soliloquy,
and they don't show anything.
And the show has never been scared of showing weird, surreal shit. It's never been scared of the Kevin episode. It's never been scared of showing a character telling a story and then cutting to footage of that story. So the fact that, I mean, A, it's such a powerful performance. Like, the fact that she's telling that and you have it in your head,
Jesus.
Of this world where, like, the power grid's off and it's really dark because only 2% of the world is actually left.
Right.
And you could picture that so incredibly. You picture her looking to her window and seeing her family. But I totally agree that this is the nicer of two stories.
Wow, you guys are all cynics up in here.
I don't think that's cynical, right? Believing in the power of people.
Right, you believe in the power of
people. Yeah, that's not cynicism. I just don't think she actually went to a parallel dimension.
Yeah, and I think the real evidence for that is the idea that she stayed in Australia, and I think that if that had actually happened, like, the idea of, like, oh, I didn't go to you because you wouldn't believe me is kind of bullshit. Like,
doesn't it make you really sad for
her? Yeah,
I feel really,
life. She, like, in prison, it was like a self-imposed imprisonment because she was a coward and she didn't want people to know that she was a coward.
Makes me bummed
for
her. But
I do wonder, it almost feels like why didn't she just kill herself? Like, why?
How did she manage the leftovers?
Yeah, I guess that's true. It just seems like what is she doing for 30 years? That's what I'm
riding her bike around. Yeah. Making a delicious looking egg sandwich.
Yeah, that's it. Just making the incredible egg sandwich.
It really does look really good.
Yeah, I mean, I guess it's pretty chill too. Also, the idea that Kevin was just going from door to door in Australia is just wild.
Do you think that this episode is called The Book of Nora, mm-hmm. kind of revealed, this is maybe a trite thing to say, but kind of revealed Nora as the protagonist of The Leftovers?
Yeah, sure. Oh, absolutely.
Yeah.
I don't think she was in the beginning, but she became the protagonist.
Like, revealed that eventually, like, that's who it was really about.
I love that it took them kind of 3 years to figure that out, because I absolutely think by the end she's the protagonist. I also don't think, like in season one, when it's about Kevin having family dinner with his daughter and her friend or whatever, it's like obviously
and killing
Nora's
dogs.
Not.
Yeah.
But, and killing dogs, exactly. But like, that's kind of what I mean in season two about the show figuring itself out. Like, mm-hmm. I think number one, tonally, it figured out what it wanted to be. But number two, like, it really, like, I think the book was clearly an incredible foundation. And like, you can't give enough credit to that, obviously, for like influencing what came after. But like, I really, the writing staff of that show and everything they managed to achieve with that foundation and the weird places they took those characters, like, Nora is the absolute best, most shining example of a character who, like, really develops so much over the course of that show.
Thanks to Carrie Coon. We have to wrap things up, but I will go around the room and let everybody get. Marty, why don't we start with you? Some final thoughts on The Leftovers.
To bring it back to Lost one more time, I do like the fact that both Jack and Kevin let go of something and then immediately regret it and spend the rest of their life traveling to Australia trying to find it.
That's a good point.
Like, and I fucking love it. Eventually, like, for Jack, it's just like a couple of years seemingly, and he's able to get it back. Whereas, like, for Kevin, it's literally 30 years of his life.
Yeah, wow. Yeah. That's a good point. Mm-hmm. And they both go to Thailand and hang out with Bai Ling.
Yeah, I really liked how Kevin Garvey got his tattoos. Kevin,
the 29th
would have been a long episode.
If it was a network show.
Yeah.
Kirk, final thoughts.
Here's to shows that are about people and ambiguity and not puzzles that we all have to solve.
Yes. Andrew.
Yeah, I think I bring up the ending of Inception a lot, like the top spinning, and it's like, that's how I want everything to end. Like, I think there's so much power in ambiguity, and I think that, like, this show, like, the fact that we can have this long of a conversation about it and that there are, like, plausible theories is just everything I want from a show. Yes. I love how short it is, like, 28 episodes. Like, I look at, like, these 13-episode Marvel seasons, and I'm like, you're way too long.
It's so nice way to be left wanting more. You're like, I wish I could get more, but that's how I want to feel.
Yeah, I wish more people had watched it. I do my best to advocate The Leftovers. I told my entire family to watch it, and they all got hooked. Like, over the past couple of weeks, my grandma, my 85-year-old grandma, was texting me about how much she loved The Leftovers. So, yes, although I guess we can't tell people listening to this to watch it, because if they have listened to this point...
There might be some maniac who listens to the whole thing.
I don't really care. Yeah, I mean, I guess
Also, this would be complete nonsense if you hadn't watched it. I think, what are they talking about? The cave woman?
Exactly. I listen to a lot of podcasts where I fold laundry. Like, I could see myself listening to some random sport.
Why not? Well, if you made it this far and you haven't watched Leftovers, go watch The Leftovers.
Yeah, it's good. You'll think you'll like it.
You will enjoy
it. You'll probably re-listen to this podcast and get more out of it.
So people can, of course, find the two of you on IGN.com. Anything else you want to plug, Marty?
No. If you want to listen to us, we're on Beyond, which is our PlayStation podcast.
I just started a
podcast with a coworker of ours, Alana Pierce, called Red Lips Orange Car. That is all about Craigslist misconnections.
Very entertaining. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Very entertaining.
Yeah, I'm Garfep on Twitter. I don't do anything other than work. So
that's
you can
just
find me
on IGN. You just work and tweet.
I play Pokemon Go a lot.
Yeah, you are incredible at Pokemon Go.
Ridiculous. Yeah. And of course, you all know where to find me and Kirk.
Yep.
And on that note, we will say goodbye.
Goodbye.
Why is that? Is that like your sign off? Just goodbye.
No, it's not. We normally really say goodbye. Goodbye, guys. This is
fun.
Goodbye.
Yeah.
Well, we have a boilerplate that'll play after this.
Yeah, it'll be one of us telling people to subscribe.
Yeah, I don't know. We don't really. Should we have a sign off?
Yeah, and I don't know.
Tim Rogers has a good one.
What's his?
It's like, I was born stupid, but I won't die with
no, I won't die hungry.
Oh, that's what it is.
I won't die hungry. Wow. Yeah. I was born stupid, but yeah. I will not die hungry.
I like that a lot.
We can't use Tim's, but it's pretty good.
We'll think of one. We'll get back to you.
Okay, perfect.
All right.
See you guys.
See ya.
Kotaku Split Screen is an official podcast of Kotaku.com. It's produced by Jason Schreier and me, Kirk Hamilton. I edit and mix the podcast and also wrote and performed our theme song and other music. We're part of the Fusion Podcast Network, where Mandana Mofidi is executive producer of audio. You can find us on popular podcast services like Panoply, NPR Now, Google Play, and Apple Podcasts, and we hope that you'll leave us a review if you like what you hear. Find old episodes at Kotaku.com/splitscreen. Email us at splitscreen@kotaku.com.